Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'll give you a minute to get situated there. The next case on our calendar today is A24-1820 VH Minneapolis South Inc. versus TJI Fridays Inc. and Akashimon LLC. As you know, each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording the oral argument here today, so I'll just remind anyone who might be listening that no other, or watching, I should say, online, that no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready, and I'll just ask that you introduce yourself and the party you represent at the start of your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Markowitz, and I represent the appellant, Akashimon LLC. Akashimon has presented two bases to reverse the district court in full that are independently dispositive. The first is the non-occurrence of the 45-day invoice furnishment condition precedent, and the second is the non-occurrence of the notice of default by certified U.S. mail condition precedent. I plan to begin my argument with the second piece because there's the least in dispute. Importantly, there's no dispute on the threshold issue of whether paragraph 7, the notice of default provision, sets forth a condition precedent to suing for breach of contract. VH does not dispute this on appeal, and the district court sort of sidestepped the issue but recognized nearly the same, recognizing, quote, that the object of this provision, paragraph 7, is to make sure the defaulting party has 10 days to cure an alleged default before facing legal action. So there's no dispute that complying with paragraph 7 is a condition precedent to suing for breach of contract, nor is there any dispute that the thing that Akashimon claims was a failure of that condition indeed failed to occur. Akashimon never received notice of default by certified U.S. mail. Certified U.S. mail is the only means of giving notice identified in paragraph 14, and paragraph 7, the operative term, required notice of default to have been received pursuant to paragraph 14. The only interpretation of that language that the court has before it today that gives any meaning to the words pursuant to paragraph 14 is the one advanced by Akashimon. It means in compliance with, in accordance with, paragraph 14. And there's no way to say that giving notice is in compliance with or in accordance with paragraph 14 if the notice is not given by the only means identified in 14. I take the argument that the word may is a permissive word. That word is in paragraph 14. But we need to look at the purposes for which these paragraphs exist. 14.
Right, but we still need to look at the plain language of the paragraph. And paragraph 14 does use a permissive and then gives an example of how the notice can be provided. So it sounds like what you're trying to do is incorporate the language from paragraph 7 to the paragraph 14.
Not at all. The condition precedent is seven.
Well, that's a separate issue of whether or not it's a condition precedent, but we'll
certainly
get to that.
Although as I understand it, it's not disputed and all but acknowledged by the district court, which resolved the case on other grounds. If we look at paragraph 14 in isolation, it is telling contracting parties, if you want to give notice to the other party and have the other party not have a reasonable grounds to object under the contract, you may do it by certified U.S. mail to a physical address.
Right, and I think that's a key provision because, I mean, parties, we've got sophisticated parties to an agreement. If the parties wanted to have the only way to provide the notice by certified mail, then why didn't the parties use the word shall? In other words, in paragraph 14, why didn't it say
Because that's not what 14's trying to do. 14's not supposed to be a straitjacket in all circumstances. It's just saying a surefire way, generally, to give notice is to use certified U.S. mail. You may do it this way.
Right. Aren't you just conceding, then, that it may is discretionary, and you're saying it's not a straitjacket way? So
if we're reading 14 in isolation as a general matter, that we're dealing with a general contract term and a specific contract term. And that general term is getting funneled into a specific one. And this is critical.
Right, but you have to read them together. And,
absolutely.
And it still says may be given under the provisions hereof by depositing it in the United States mail, certified mail. And so may suggests that it doesn't necessarily have to be certified. United States mail could be sufficient.
Imagine for a moment that the words pursuant to paragraph 14 were entirely omitted from paragraph 7. The result would be the same. If a party can provide notice by whatever means they want when it comes to notice of default, the party's never had to use the words pursuant to paragraph 14. You could literally strike it out, and this contract would operate the same in that world. And I think that's critical. We have a basic rule of contract interpretation that say words have to have meaning, they have to do work. And if...
Well, isn't the work that it's doing identifying specific... addresses to which notice can be sent?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's saying pursuant to paragraph 14, quote the whole language being, after such party's receipt of notice of default pursuant to paragraph 14, I think it's saying the specific addresses are one specific way you can send certified mail, but the more important piece is you must send certified U.S. mail. I'm not sure what work it used to do to say, like, there's some addresses over there. That's just a very different set of language. Pursuant to means in accordance with pursuant to. I don't see how just saying, look at those addresses over there, would make those words actually do the work they're supposed to do.
Your pursuant to argument keeps reading out the word may, right? I mean, if you're saying pursuant to is mandatory, that you must do certified mail, which is what I think you just said, then the word may becomes shall.
Not at all, Your Honor. It's if you look at 14 by itself and parties just start there and say, I want to give notice of X or Y or Z for whatever purpose, here's one way you may do it. But then when 7, it needs to be read in light of it to give both terms meaning. This is the only interpretation that lets may do the work of may when read in isolation and lets pursuant to 14 do the work of pursuant to 14 read with that provision.
That doesn't, I'm having a hard time following your logic here because the language in paragraph 7 says pursuant to paragraph 14. In other words, look to paragraph 14, right?
That's a very different set of words than look. I agree. If it look to would be in a different world. Pursuant to means you have to obey something. You have to do something in compliance with. This is Black's Law Dictionary style things in accordance with. And I think look to is very different from in compliance with, comply with it. If 14 is just a free-for-all notice term, and it, regardless of the context in which it falls, then pursuant to paragraph 14 does no work. I just don't think there's a way to give both provisions meaning in that
world. Okay, let me rephrase it. And I'm just trying to put in colloquial terms, just plain English language.
Absolutely.
Pursuant to paragraph 14 says you have to go to paragraph 14. Would that be a fair way of paraphrasing it?
I still don't think it's a go there, take a visit. I understand that's colloquial.
I'm not saying there, go there if you want to. I think it says you have to go to paragraph 14, right?
Such parties receipt of notice of default pursuant to paragraph 14. Notice of default pursuant to paragraph 14.
You have to go to paragraph 14.
Yes,
that's
absolutely.
What it's saying, right?
Yes.
Okay. Then you go to paragraph 14, but then paragraph 14 says that notice may be given by, and it gives one example. I guess my point is we have to assume parties to a contract use particular language for a reason.
Absolutely.
And the parties, for whatever reason, use may. May is permissive.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. So if may is permissive, then it says may... that the notice may be given by, and then it gives an example of certified mail. So if it's permissive, that means other means of providing notice can be provided as well, right?
In the generally, if you're looking to provide another party notice for whatever reasons, yes. It's just saying one surefire way is certified U.S. mail.
Okay, so why isn't that the situation here then? That seems to be the plain language of that.
Specific terms control over the general, and we must interpret contracts to give meaning to all the words therein, and I think this is the only one that does it. And I note the outcome here would be if the court affirmed saying the notice by something that was not certified U.S. mail was sufficient, pursuant to paragraph 14 really but didn't need to be there. Paragraph 14 was already out there that said notice may be given in this
right,
way.
Right, paragraph 14 gives an example of one way to do it. It's obviously one of the most secure ways of doing it, the most definitive ways. It certainly seems to be a recommended way.
I see the time ticking down, and I see I'm not getting a yes on this answer. If I could go to a few other arguments.
Sure.
So if on the sticking with notice of default, there are 10 invoices, and there is no dispute here that no notice of default by any means to anyone was given for invoices 5 through 10. The district court's reasoning here was similar to VH's reasoning, which is that you don't need to have updated notice of default. But we look at notice of default, the word default is used in this contract, and it seems to be a synonym for breach. The note doesn't seem to be any other reasonable meaning there. And you can't provide notice of a default or a breach that didn't happen yet. And I think that is, at the bare minimum, requires reversing and remanding at least as to those 6 invoices and the attorney's fees that were awarded, because that would reduce the liability judgment by half.
Didn't we enter a really different world when the lawsuit was filed in, 2020? That, okay, and the respondent said, we reserve the right to update this if there is a continuing default.
I don't know what reservation of rights that would be, but that you can't unilaterally modify the contract. And the contract says, and the object of the contract, according to the district court, is you must provide notice of default as to such default and give an opportunity to cure for 10 days, and you only can sue afterwards. The litigation cannot be the notice, and providing ongoing litigation notice of different defaults cannot be the notice that is required for pre-suit. I think that at a bare minimum requires reversal there. I'm happy to talk about the condition or the disproportionate forfeiture arguments or otherwise rest on the briefing there. I think that's pretty clear. The district court made a sua sponte decision that was wrong under Athena. The exception doesn't go that far. I reserve arguments to that for rebuttal if needed. And I'll move on to the 45-day invoice term. And I think what's really striking here is this 45-day time limit is inextricably intertwined, sandwiched between two terms that are undisputed to be conditions precedent. The delivery of an invoice to inform Akashimon of what expenses VH or BHI incurred is a condition precedent that's conceded by VH, conceded that the trigger, VH and BHI were, quote, required to provide Akashimon with an invoice detailing the common area expenses, et cetera, in order to trigger the requirement to pay. And there's the reasonable verification requirement, which the duty to pay is subject to. For VH and the district court to be right here, we have to snip out the 45-day term that the parties agreed was going to be the deadline here from indisputed conditions precedent. I don't think you can do that without slicing and dicing beyond what the clear language of the parties have told us. We have magic words on the second. We have an inherent condition precedent on the first. The parties have told us the deadline for doing so. That is part of the condition precedent that is both conceded and undisputed on appeal.
Is there any case that you think addresses a similar argument, Minnesota case?
Yeah, the closest case I could find is this court's non-precedential decision in EDF-RE.
Uh-huh.
We quoted in our brief. This court concludes that language creates the invoice condition precedent. I'll note it doesn't rely on the 7-day deadline there, but
yeah,
the 7-day deadline is attached with within language.
That did seem a little different to me, but you think that is the closest case?
I think it's the closest case in Minnesota, with the other supporting case being outside of Minnesota, Walton. Again, there was not a deadline attached to it, but it was the invoice of common area expenses as part of a lease were a condition precedent to having a duty to pay.
Isn't that a significant difference, though, that there is no deadline attached to it because in this particular case, because you... In this one, it seems more kind of, a notice of, hey, this is your opportunity once you receive this to object if there's something that you dispute. And, in fact, in one situation, there was a dispute of one particular charge.
I think that would be a strange way to slice and dice. You have magic words.
Okay, thank you. So you're saying my way of slicing and dicing is strange.
I don't think so. I think the unambiguous meaning here, when you have two conditions precedent that we don't dispute are conditions precedent and there's a time limit attached to them, we just can't sever it. And there's also the furnishment problem.
But what unequivocal language makes the 45 days a condition precedent?
It's attached to an undisputed condition precedent, and the word within loops it in. It says we have this condition precedent of an invoice. No one disputes it. It's conceded to be a condition precedent. And within 45 days is the language that loops it in.
But you're using language from a separate paragraph.
Same sentence.
Or a separate sentence from... I think you're referring to the first sentence versus the second sentence in terms of the unequivocal language.
So sentence two is the one with the subject to language, subject to reasonable right of verification. Sentence one is the undisputed invoice condition precedent that is not disputed and is conceded on appeal. I see my time is ticking down. I do want to make a point on furnishment, because even if we ignore the deadline piece, we're still looking at furnished on people who are not Akashimon. I think this one point, we make it in our reply. My time's ticking down. We've argued it in the briefing. The point I want to make here is this. Burden of proof. VH had the burden of proof here. And one striking piece about, may I briefly conclude, Your Honor?
Very briefly.
Yes.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Akashimon, no corporate designee for Akashimon testified at trial because no corporate designee for Akashimon was called. Anil Yadav was not called. Kevorkian was not called. This court might have lots of questions as to what exactly was going on the ground. Those gaps there were left by VH, the party with the burden of proof. I reserve time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court. My name is Patrick Rooney. I represent the plaintiff and respondent, VH Minneapolis South Incorporated. The appellant has made three arguments in their brief, three main arguments. I'd like to address all three if I have time, but let me just start with the certified mail issue because that was the one that counsel spent most time on. Basic argument seems to be that because there is pursuant to language in paragraph 7, that the language in paragraph 14, which contains permissive language, becomes or somehow turns into mandatory language. That is simply not a reasonable reading of this contract. Pursuant to, as Akashimon acknowledges in their brief, essentially means in reliance on or in reference to or in response to. In connection with. If you have that language in your agreement, and it says, one paragraph says, as the court has basically acknowledged, you have to do something pursuant to another paragraph. You look to the other paragraph to determine what needs to be done. That other paragraph, in this case, is paragraph 14, and that's a permissive.
Doesn't your interpretation render the provisions or the detail in section 14, paragraph 14, meaningless? Because it provides one way to give notice, and if you don't do it that way, then that language basically disappears.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what that language means is that if you send it by certified mail, you are following one method acknowledged and agreed to in paragraph 14. But what paragraph 14 doesn't say is that's the only method.
But why specify that if the intent is you can give notice however you want? I mean, isn't that essentially your argument, that as long as notice is given in some manner, that's sufficient to meet the requirements of pursuant to paragraph 14?
I don't think so. It's simply if you send it by certified mail, that takes the issue of whether the notice was received off the table. But if you send it other ways, then the issue becomes, did you actually receive it? And so for whatever reason, VH and its predecessor chose to not send it by certified mail. But the evidence in this case is absolutely clear that the notices, as well as the default notices, the invoices and default notices, were in fact received. And so this is really sort of much ado about nothing. 5 years of invoices were sent, and default notices were sent that were received. There's no question about that. There's multiple documents that indicate that. There's testimony that supports it.
Were all the invoices received within that 45-day period?
One was not. There's one invoice that was sent. It was 37 days late. Don't know why it was 37 days late. But then the question becomes with regard to that invoice, which is a separate issue from the certified mail issue. What is the consequence of that one invoice being sent 37 days late? Now, the defendant here would argue that that means that that invoice is wiped clean. They don't have to pay that invoice because it was sent 37 days late. Now, this gets to the other argument that was presented as to whether this 45-day requirement is a condition precedent or not. Now, if you look at the language in which the 45-day requirement is located, it says it has two sentences, not one sentence. The first sentence references the 45-day requirement. Within 45 days following the end of each one-half calendar year period, grantor shall furnish grantee a statement covering the period just expired, showing the detailed breakout of the common area expenses. It then has a second sentence that says, subject to the right of reasonable verification, the invoice amount shall be paid within 20 days of receipt. Now, what Koshman wants to argue is that the second sentence, which is a condition precedent, in other words, there has to be a received invoice for them to pay. They want to argue that that second sentence somehow incorporates or involves the 45-day requirement. These are two separate things. Sending the invoice within 45 days is not a condition precedent to paying the invoice. The only condition precedent is the receipt of the invoice. Then there's 20 days to
how
pay.
How do you get there, though, because it's all the requirement to furnish the notice starts out with within 45 days following the end of each half calendar year, MCP shall furnish RGI a statement covering the period just expired, da-da-da-da-da,
right.
And then subject to the right of reasonable verification by RGI, it shall pay the invoice. So how is it logical to read the providing of the requirement to provide an invoice as a condition precedent but not include the 45 days, given it's all part of the same sentence?
No, it's not part of the same sentence.
Well,
it's part
the requirement to furnish the invoice is part of the same sentence as the 45 days, and
no.
That's a condition precedent.
With all respect, it's two sentences.
Well, I agree there are two sentences there, but
yeah.
But subject to the right of reasonable verification ties in the requirement to provide the invoice.
Right.
And that sentence about providing the invoice includes the 45 days. So my question is, and sorry if I didn't articulate it very well, but how is it logical to read only part of that first sentence as the condition precedent and not the entire thing?
I think it's logical in this way, and I think this is the way the district court interpreted it. There's a requirement to send an invoice before the invoice has to be paid. The contract has a provision that says it should be sent or recommends that it be sent within 45 days. If it's not sent within 45 days, a Koshman ends up getting more time to pay that invoice than it otherwise would have gotten. But that doesn't mean the invoice doesn't ever have to be paid. It simply says you have more time. I think there's an interesting case which we didn't cite in our brief, but I do think it is helpful on this issue. It's called Beeler versus Katz. It's a 2001 unpublished decision. It's a very short decision, but it is, I think, quite interesting in how close it is to the facts of our case. In Beeler, there was a sale of a business. The purchaser paid, I think it was $38 million for the business, and within the purchase agreement, there was a provision that said, if within 45 days you want to obtain a modification of the purchase price based on information you've learned now that you own the business, you can submit your request within 45 days. The purchaser did not submit the request within 45 days. He was actually 35 days late. What the court said in that case, Court of Appeals said, that does not mean that the purchaser has lost or forfeited his right to seek the modification because, number one, there was no time of the essence provision in that agreement, just as here, there's no times of the essence provision. And number two, and this is probably the most important point, there's no showing of prejudice in the late request for the modification, just as here. There's no evidence and no argument was made by Koshman that they were prejudiced by this one invoice being sent 37 days late. And what's interesting is that the agreement has a provision that sort of accepts the possibility that there will be invoices submitted later than 45 days when it says that the hotel, VH, has to retain its records for a year after the receipt of the invoice to allow Koshman to verify and review the documents. So without any times of the essence clause and without any evidence of prejudice, there's no basis to conclude that one invoice sent 37 days late should somehow wipe out the debt. The debt was still incurred, and it needs to be and must be paid as the district court quite reasonably interpreted.
Can you give us the cite to the
yes, deal? I can. It is, since it's unpublished, I can give you the Lexis site and the...
The Westlaw, if you have it, would be better. Otherwise, or just the spelling of the names.
Well, I think I only have the Lexis site. It's Lexis 432. The spelling is B-E-E-L-E-R versus Katz, K-A-T-Z. It's a 2001 case, April 24, 2001.
Thank you.
Actually, I do have the Westlaw site. It's Westlaw 410342.
Can you address the argument about that there was no notice for invoices related to invoices 5 through 10?
Yes. Okay. Here's the situation with regard to those notices. The case was filed and commenced in 2023. There was a notice of default provided before that case. After the case was commenced, additional amounts were accruing because Koshman continued to not pay what was owed under the easement. So the parties were already in a lawsuit. It was the same parties with the same contract making the same claims. Koshman was certainly on notice that they were in default. And they were receiving the invoices both from VH directly, as they had been in the past, and also as part of the discovery in the case at hand. So each time an invoice came due, it was produced to VH produced to Koshman directly by VH, but it was also produced in the lawsuit as part of discovery, as an update to discovery each time. Now, there's no question that those invoices were received, and there's no argument that those invoices were not received within 45 days of the deadline. The argument, as I understand, Koshman is making is that they didn't get updated default notices with regard to those invoices. And in that regard, that argument really makes no sense. Because keep in mind, as we've pointed out in the brief, the default notices were sent multiple ways and multiple times prior to the lawsuit being instituted. At that point, Koshman is on notice that they are in default. Once they're in default, there's no requirement that additional default notices be sent because they're in a lawsuit in which the very essence or presence of the lawsuit is that they are in default.
Well, isn't the default specific to an individual invoice?
The default is that they are in default under the easement agreement.
So then you can raise any argument if there's one default and you bring a lawsuit, you can raise in the lawsuit, you can add in any additional defaults, is your view?
It's our view that when you have one agreement where there's been a default by the defendant in that agreement, that defendant has been put on notice of that default, a lawsuit has been instituted, they are now on notice that they are considered in default. And as the additional invoices accrue, there's no need to give those additional notices because they already are in default and they already know they're in default.
How are they in default for additional invoices if it hasn't, you know, if the payment time hasn't expired?
Well, the payment time had expired by the time the lawsuit went to trial. So,
by the time it went to trial, but
right.
Not when it was filed.
But now there were some invoices that hadn't accrued yet.
Right, that's what I'm getting at.
So the argument that Akashman is making is that even though they're being sued for violation of the easement agreement, and they're in a lawsuit in which the invoices are being provided to them, and they're being sued for violation of those or failure to pay those invoices, they needed to get additional default notices for each of those invoices. That's their argument. The purpose of the default notice was to give 10 days to cure. There's no reasonable argument that Akashman didn't have 10 days to cure the failure to pay these invoices once they were in the lawsuit. They certainly had that opportunity at any point prior to the trial.
By the time it went to trial, there was no dispute that they hadn't been paid in accordance with the
correct
agreement.
Yes. That each time that the invoice was due, it was sent to them, they were notified, they had 10 days from the point at which that invoice was sent to pay, or excuse me, 20 days to pay, and by virtue of the fact that the lawsuit had already started, and they were told they were in default, and they were in default, there's no reason or reasonable argument that the VH should have to send additional updated default notices when they already know they're in default.
Well, I think counsel's argument is that they're not in default under the invoices that hadn't accrued before the lawsuit was filed, the new invoices.
They were not in default of those invoices at the time the lawsuit started. That's correct.
Right, and then they're not in default even later because you didn't send the notice. Any party shall be in default under provisions of this agreement. And so there's a new invoice that hadn't been paid, and you need to send a notice of default for each of those invoices that they haven't paid.
Well, I would submit that once the party is in default, once Akashman is in default, they have no basis to demand further compliance with the agreement by VH, because under standard law, I guess my time is up here, once you're in default, you lose the right to require the other side to comply with the agreement. But beyond that, they did get notices. Now, they weren't sent to them by certified mail, but they got notice as part of the lawsuit that you have not paid this invoice and you are in default. By virtue of the fact that you're being sued, it seems incongruous to argue that you didn't know you were in default when you're being sued at the very same time. My time is up.
Thank you. One more question.
Yes.
Thank you. If you could address briefly the issue of providing notice to parties that people that were not the named party.
Yeah, this is an issue that counsel didn't address directly, but there were four people that notices were sent to prior to the time BH purchased the hotel. Tajal Chosky, Kevin Kevorkian, Stacy Franklin, and Terry Sales. That's the group that was sent to whom the invoices were sent by the prior hotel owner. And from 2016 to 2018, the invoices were paid. The invoices sent to that group were paid. On top of that, in 2019, two of those folks, Franklin and Chosky, asked for a sit-down and received a sit-down with the hotel to complain about some of the items included in the invoices. Not the protocol as to whom the invoices were sent to, but some of the items included. After that, when VH took over and purchased the hotel, they sent the invoices to the same people following the same protocol. At no time was there ever any objection that the wrong people were receiving the invoices? And there's multiple instances and evidence in the case in which Mr. Yadav, who owns and manages Akashman, as well as his attorney, Mr. Kevorkian, spoke directly to VH about these invoices. So if the argument is that we didn't receive the invoices, we didn't know about the invoices, that's not supported at all by the evidence. If the argument is that there was specific people or person to whom the invoices should have been sent, the easement doesn't contain that information. Because remember, the easement was entered some 26 years before Akashman purchased the property and 30 years before VH purchased the property. So there's nothing directly in the easement that says to whom these invoices are supposed to be sent. It's a missing component, missing part. And because it's a missing part, the court was justified in looking at conduct of the parties and the pattern that the parties had followed and the reasonable expectations of the parties as to who should receive these invoices. The fact that they weren't employees of Akashman is irrelevant. The parties, including Mr. Yadav, by his actions or inactions, had endorsed this process as to who should get the invoices. They did get the invoices. They were fully aware of the invoices.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One last attempt at this tree before I move on to other things. If the outcome of this case is that notice of default by means other than certified U.S. mail was sufficient, then I submit to the court that the words pursuant to paragraph 14 don't do the work they normally would do. We have to substitute words like look to, take a peek at, take a trip over to, and I think that is telling for why the only interpretation that gives meaning to both terms, both the 7 and 14, is the one advanced.
Did your client provide an address for paragraph 14 of where the notice of default should be sent?
That's not in the record, but we do know VH had an address for Akashimon. The public tax records that are in the record.
But did your client update the contract?
No, it did not, and I don't think that's required. If you look at the bottom of 14, it refers to...
So had they sent the notice to the address that's listed there, would that have been sufficient?
No, because that's for a different party. The language reads at the bottom, requiring certified U.S. mail at the following addresses or such other address as may be designated from time to time.
Well, that's what I mean. They didn't designate a new address.
And they weren't required to. If the contract had said at the address below or an address that you designate, that would be one thing, but that's not what it says.
How were they not required to if you're arguing there has to be strict compliance with paragraph 14? You know, it seems either the requirement is to send it by certified mail to one of those designated addresses or an address as may be designated from time to time by any party.
An important feature of this contract is that it runs with the land. The parties who are going to be bound by it are not necessarily ever going to even meet. There is no requirement in the contract that there are amendments to supplement the addresses. It just says the benefits and burdens run with the land.
Well, it says as may be designated from time to time by any party for itself. So that would be your clients for themselves designating an address. Like if we're supposed to strictly construe this term as it must be certified mail, the contract by your client failing to designate doesn't say where to send the certified mail.
And I think this is an area where may is significant. This is a permissive term that says as may be designated after the words such other address.
Which then gets back to the idea that, well, what they did do is fine because they sent it. It was received may. It didn't have to be certified mail.
Well, let's talk about that. Then, so the last six invoices weren't sent to any, or there was no notice of default sent to anyone for any reason by any means. And if we look at the first four, and I didn't get a chance to talk about that in opening, we address it in our reply brief, and I draw the court's attention to pages of 2 and 3. VH argues that it sent notice of default to Kevorkian. This is the personal lawyer for Mr. Yadav. There's no showing that he's an employee of Akashimon. It's not by certified mail.
Was there ever any objection by Akashimon to notice to these individuals? Because it went on for some time.
And Akashimon did not pay for some time. That's one of the strange things I find about this argument. There was no objection. There's no evidence of Akashimon receiving the invoices. The past practice is pointed to, but then clearly that past practice stopped.
But there were payments that were made from 2006 to 2018 from the notice being provided to those three or four individuals.
And as to the question of what changed between 2018 and 2019 would have been a very good question to ask perhaps Neil Yadav or a representative for Akashimon. There was no attempt by the party with the burden of proof to actually explain what's going on by asking the people with firsthand knowledge.
But Akashimon didn't say anything about, I'm changing our practices. They've been accepting and paying invoices in a certain way for a long time and then just stopped payment, even though it was being sent to the exact same people.
There's a no-waiver clause, and there's a no-modification except for in writing clause in the contract. In order for the conduct of the parties to matter in that sense, I submit it would have to be through saying there was a waiver of an obligation or a right to insist on certain performance under the contract or modification, both of which are prohibited.
But they're playing a game of gotcha. This seems like some bad faith dealings by not saying, hey, we're changing our practices. Where you can't be sending them to the people who you've sent them before who have then paid every single bill that's been sent.
What I find strange about this record is that at any time VH could have said, okay, we're not getting paid, let's find an actual address for Akashimon, not for people who don't work for Akashimon. It's available on the Secretary of State's website.
Paragraph 14 says, as may be designated from time to time by any party for itself.
And VH certainly could have asked Akashimon, what address can we use for you?
Or Akashimon could have provided an address.
That also could have occurred. Akashimon had a public address online and...
Well, it seems like you're wanting to have discretion under paragraph 14, but not discretion. So how is your argument? In other words, it must be certified mail, but then where it goes, the party has complete discretion. How is that consistent with paragraph 14?
Not my argument at all. Sorry, Your Honor.
I think that is what you were arguing because you said that it didn't have to be sent to those addresses there. They could send it. The parties changed, so it had to be sent somewhere else. But that's not what it says.
If I may take a pass at that answer, I see my time is expired. This is a contract that was written in 1989 that was intended to run with the land, and that did run with the land. The addresses that were initially listed there were for the original contracting parties. There's no requirement in the contract to say that in order for the benefits and burdens to run, you need to be updating your addresses. You may.
Well, I disagree with that view, but we certainly know that the contract runs with the land, but we're looking at paragraph 14. So,
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I would say the as may is not a requirement. You don't have to be updating. It could be to any physical address. The operative terms are certified U.S. mail.
But even though it says may be given by certified mail?
So generally, final attempt, and I'll sit.
Please.
I submit that if you take this contract and you remove the words pursuant to paragraph 14 and you read paragraph 14 or paragraph 14 and just read it as is, and then you read paragraph 7 without pursuant to paragraph 14, it results in the exact same outcome the district court reached and the exact same one VH is requesting. That means those words are meaningless. We have a rule against interpreting words to leave words meaningless, and there is a way to read them giving them meaning. The one Akashimon is presenting, which is as argued in the general sense, yes, notice generally may be given in that way, but when you're dealing with specifically notice of default, it must be given in that way because of pursuant to paragraph 14.
But I think the court... It seems wrong to me, though, to put the burden on your opposing counsel to find the address, because paragraph 14 is designated from time to time by any party for itself. So it's your client's obligation to update the address, which then goes to both certified mail and where they're going to be sending invoices.
If I've not persuaded the court that, I think this is an area where may actually does matter. We're talking about may above really being important. May is really important down here. I think the way to read this contract, and I think truly the most reasonable way to read it, is that when you read to the bottom of 14, give me a moment, or such other address, as may be designated, that there is a pause there. And the Akashvan's not hiding the ball for what his address, its address is. It's on the Secretary of State's website. It could have provided it if it was asked. And again, VH is the one that produced a record in this case, which is a public tax record, which identifies Akashvan's address. They could have known. There was no hiding of the ball.
But VH as may be designated, you're missing the last part, any party for itself. That means it's the party where the address is. They need to do the designation.
And I respectfully submit that that's not the most reasonable reading of those words, in part because it's a contract that runs with the land that's not requiring parties to ever meet and amend the contract to actually designate addresses. That would be must language. It would be, that would convert the may to a must, as must be designated.
At the following addresses, so it's use these addresses, or such addresses as may be designated from time to time, which means those addresses may change. And they did, and your client didn't designate.
I think to read the interpretation Your Honor is pressing would be one that would require a mandate. Somehow we'd have to say the contract is requiring that a party provide an updated address by amended contract in order to avail itself of the benefits of the notice of default requirement. And I think that is really injecting language and converting mays to musts. And I hope I persuaded you, but I know my time is up. I appreciate the court for its time, and I thank you for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and helpful arguments and answers to our questions here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.